Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room is Speaker Paul Menzel. And title of his talk is Embracing Death, Doctor-Assisted Suicide, and the Law.
There are connections, of course, with birth and beginning of life definition questions, one of which we'll see today, but there's no special session on reproduction dilemmas, as I initially thought I might do. If you feel misled, so be it, I guess. Talk. Why don't I have interest in that area too, and we could certainly have a productive conversation. Today, I want to talk on something that I'm very much a novice about in a way. I'm a philosopher by trade, and I'm going to give you an interpretation of a particular legal argument and a reaction to it. I do not mean this to be any kind of comprehensive statement on the pros and cons of physician-assisted suicide. Instead, I'm just going to state an analysis, and then we can let the discussion roll from there. I emphasize not only that this is not necessarily my comprehensive sizing up of the whole situation, but secondly, that it is a commentary on a legal analysis, and I'm trying to make it itself, my commentary, a kind of legal analysis, which I'll stress at the end when we see some of the distinctions, I think is not a solution to the ethical dilemmas at all, but a particular way of looking at the question of what autonomy the state should or shouldn't allow individual patients and physicians in our society. Some of you in Washington State, maybe some of you across the nation, maybe some of you not at all, have heard of the June 1994 decision by a now famous judge, famous in healthcare ethics circles at least, Barbara Rothstein in Seattle. And this is the first decision in the federal courts, federal district court, in which the conclusion came out for a constitutionally protected right of physician-assisted suicide. There are several interesting aspects of this case. First of all, it dealt with several patients who simply wanted their physicians to be able to provide them with lethal agents, which they could use themselves at the time they would think appropriate. All these patients are in various stages of what we call terminal illness. Terminal is, of course, notoriously difficult to define. We're all terminal in a sense. Right now, these three patients have diseases which physicians are willing to say are in end-stage conditions. End-stage is, of course, difficult to define. The interesting focus of the case is that it is on physician-assisted suicide. It is not a decision about direct active euthanasia. It is a decision about what a physician may do to help a patient end her his own life. It's partly because of that reason that I have pre-titled this talk, Embracing Death. It is not merely allowing death to come, but it is also not, I think, appropriately described as killing, at least not from the perspective of the physician, though we could have arguments about that. It is assisting the patient in ending her his own death. If you can call that embracing, if you want, that's one word sort of intermediate between just allowing death to come, so-called passive euthanasia, and active direct killing that I thought was possibly appropriate. The grounds of Judge Rothstein's decision were that it followed primarily from a line of right to privacy cases, most particularly Roe v. Wade, the famous abortion case, and also from some decisions about death choices. In particular, the Cruzan case, which oddly enough had gone against the patient and, or at least, the patient's family. So let me make a comment on those two grounds of the Rothstein decision, because they are, I think, the core of the argument. First, the element in Roe v. Wade, the abortion decision. Very clearly, Judge Rothstein thought that this was, that the key element here was the fact that despite all the other controversial parts of the Roe v. Wade decision, finally the key element is whether or not the state should define when the status a person with rights begins. And the Roe v. Wade decision, as interpreted by Rothstein, claims that post-birth, or certainly maybe even post-viability, though there the Roe v. Wade decision is itself somewhat ambiguous, society is virtually unanimous in agreeing that the human being is a person with rights, but that at certain pre-viability, at most pre-viability stages of fetal human existence, we are not agreed at all as a society on whether this entity has human rights. It is unquestionably a human being, but is it a human legal person or a human moral person? Just describing it that way, not as a biological human being, but as a human moral person, obviously implies that people are going to have significant differences of opinion on when that status begins, and that those differences of opinion will vary in relation to, among other things, different, widely different, and strongly held religious beliefs. If that's the case, then is it the job of the state to say one answer to that question of when fetal moral personhood begins is the correct one that should govern our social relations? The Roe v. Wade court answer is no. That's a matter of privacy. Now, perhaps a more correct characterization of it is that's a matter of either the neutrality of the government vis-a-vis religion, or a matter of the free exercise of religious beliefs. And so there's a good bit of scholarly controversy about what precisely this right to privacy means, whether it really is, in fact, not just a First Amendment freedom of religion argument. At any rate, Judge Rothstein observed that if, in fact, the decision of a person carrying a fetus about when moral personhood begins is itself something highly personal and highly and varies highly with one's most basic religious and moral beliefs, then clearly also some of the decisions one makes in deciding whether allowing death to come also permits active takings of life. Allowing death to come, we have said, in many cases in our society, is permissible. Certainly legally permissible. The conviction of whether or not allowing death to come also means that certain takings of life are justified is equally a personal decision and is going to vary equally with some of one's basic philosophical and moral and religious beliefs, just as much as one's belief about fetal personhood are going to vary with those basic beliefs. If that's the case, then if Roe protected the pregnant woman's and her physician's right to have an abortion pre-viability, then also her decision should protect a physician's and patient's right for the physician to assist her. Now, at this point, why the decision shouldn't also be that the physician could directly kill her, we get into the intersection with another area of law, the letting die decisions. You may remember that the Cruzan case, right now remember the date of it, 91, was a case of a long, persistent vegetative state patient, Nancy Cruzan, whose parents appealed to the courts to protect their right to let her die, to remove life support, in this case, nutrition and hydration, administered by TUB, our official nutrition hydration, even though she had not left a written directive to that effect. And the federal court, the Supreme Court, finally said that the state of Missouri could demand absolutely clear, convincing evidence higher than was met by the evidence that her family brought to bear, that in fact, if she were here talking to us today, looking down on her situation as a permanently unconscious person, she herself would say, "Let me die." The higher standard that had to be met was one that could have been met, for example, by a written advance directive. It wasn't met. The Supreme Court said the state of Missouri was not doing anything unconstitutional in saying that this higher standard had to be met, but it hadn't been met, in Nancy Kurzan's case, and therefore the parents couldn't remove the artificial nutrition and hydration. The reason that this decision connects with, the respect in which it connects with the physician-assisted suicide case that Judge Rothstein decided, is that the court did imply that if there was clear and convincing evidence that a patient wanted to die, then the state would not be in order in saying you couldn't die. Now, it's still a clear and convincing evidence standard in the context of allowing to die, not any active killing. But the emphasis in that decision was not at all on the fact that it was allowing to die. The emphasis was on the clear and convincing evidence standard. But clearly, in physician-assisted suicide, the clear and convincing evidence standard, the court said, at least in these three cases that were brought to Judge Rothstein, has been met. Because the patient finally does the act. It is not the physician who injects, pushes the plunger on, of the lethal agent into the veins before the patient had a chance to change her decision at the last minute. You know, that scenario in which we say, gee, you know, maybe she was about to open her mouth and say, no, I want one more day. If it's the patient who finally swallows the pill, or the patient who finally, this is the genius of, or the devilish character of Kevorkian's setup, depending on how you look at it, is that the patient pushes the plug or pulls the lever. Pushes the button or pulls the lever. In that case, as long as we have evidence that the person was of a clear state of mind at the time and that they're following through on swallowing the pill or pushing the button is consistent with their previous testimony, then why would we think the claim that this is clear and convincing evidence that they wanted to embrace death at this point, why would we think that standard had not been met? The burden of proof clearly falls on other parties who want to claim that the standard has not been met at that point. Those parties could not bring forth those arguments in the case of these three people. In the Rothstein case, therefore, the Kurzan decision, even though it went against a patient's decision to let a person die, becomes a case in favor of these patients being allowed to self-administer lethal agents, which they get from their physicians. Now, I think you can see from that the key in this ruling, at least in the last part of the argument there, is that it is physician-assisted suicide, not directly physician-administered lethal agent. However, if there were cases where there was as much evidence that this was the final patient's will, that an active killing was the final patient's will, as there is in the case of finally, patient-administered suicide, then maybe this decision would also protect, as a constitutional right, the right to have a physician administer the lethal agent. And to be sure, those are awfully thin lines, and one doesn't know exactly where this ruling would go. Now, what I would argue here is that we need to note how minimal the argument is. It is not an argument that the views of a person who wants the assistance of a physician to then self-administer lethal agents is that those views are morally sustainable. It is only the view that they are morally plausible. It's not the claim that those views are right. It's the view that they're not demonstrably wrong enough for the society to interfere with them. Now, another element that comes into the argument would have to be that these are cases which, if allowed to progress to their conclusion, in like cases in the future in society, will not create such havoc in the society or such great potential for abuse that other values of the society would be harmed by allowing these patients access to this very private decision to embrace death. The fact that, and here the clear and convincing standard of evidence becomes, evidential standard becomes crucial, the significant abuses that we all think of are cases where other people kill people for the other people's values finally about whether that life is worth living anymore. Now that can happen in two ways. It can happen because the person's views have not been elicited, or it can happen because the person's views have been elicited but they've been coerced or pressured ways created by the others to match the others' desire to get this person out of the way instead of the decision finally representing the will of the patient. Again, here I think it's the fact that it is physician-assisted suicide that becomes weighty in the argument that the abuses in this sort of case will be minimal. You can never absolutely secure yourself and society against the possibility of abuse in any kind of legal ruling. But the argument of Judge Rothstein here is that these abuses will be minimal if a very high, clear and convincing standard of evidence about the patient's will is met. And in these cases, they are. If in the future we allow states to bar death decisions where that high standard is not met, then will we not have minimized abuses? If in fact some people think that those embracings of death are still abuses, isn't that their judgment, not the judgment, the authentic judgment of the patient? And if that's the case, the patient should still be allowed the freedom to do this, even if some abuses will be created, some events will come to fruition down the line that other people will see as abuses. All I would want to claim here is that it is very difficult to argue that because of morally treacherous views, the patient who has these views should not be allowed to carry them out in a particular case. If we were a very different society that was unified around a philosophical view that said, for example, that when you interfere with nature, you are interfering with God's will, and when you allow nature to take its course, you are letting God's will come to fruition. If we were a society that remotely agreed on that, then perhaps we could come to a very different decision in this case. But not only are we not a society that agrees on that, we aren't even a society that by and large, that even a majority of believes that. because we have an institution of medicine in which we routinely interfere with nature, not thinking that we're interfering with God's will at all, but where we think that human perceptions about what a good life is and human perceptions about how to achieve that represent God's will, even when nature is going the other way. If we've said that in many, many, many cases in our society, then how can we say that we must interpret? We could still perhaps say that we may interpret, but how can we say we must interpret the active interference with the course of nature represented by administration of a lethal agent as interference with the will of God? It might be interference with the will of God, but isn't it plausible for a person to say, here, human perception and human decision, after one has suffered enough, and of course that decision is a very private one, one that will vary a lot with individual circumstances, isn't that perception finally one that the individual should make? As I said, this is not an all-in argument. My commentary on the case is not an all-in argument that physician-assisted suicide is morally right. It is only an argument that the reasons that Judge Rothstein marshaled were sufficient to get her to her conclusion are such minimal reasons that it's going to be very hard in the long run for the legal system to disagree with her view. Now, as a matter of practical fact, in the legal system, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see her view overturned upon appeal, just because it is a new step in the law, even if its reasoning has a lot of roots in the law. But at some point or other, I would be surprised in our society, it may be 30 years from now rather than 1 year from now, to see this decision become relatively settled law. As I said, however, it doesn't at all settle the question of what's right to do. There's another thing it doesn't settle. It doesn't settle what the issue of what the line is between physician-assisted suicide and active killing. Texas is an interesting case here. Texas has, for a long time, had a rule permitting suicide, and had a body of law in which suicide was permitted. So that in Texas, you cannot stop a person from committing suicide. You can stop them only to check to see whether that's really what they want. But ultimately, if after several attempts and verbal explanation that this really is what they want, in Texas law, you cannot stop them. But in Texas law, it is illegal to assist. It is illegal actively to assist a suicide. It is not illegal to make the means of suicide available, but it is illegal actively to assist the suicide. So, in Texas, lawyers and medical ethicists throw out the following example. Well, in Texas law, it is not permissible to spoon feed a patient poison when they couldn't get the spoon to their mouth, because it's possible that the swallowing reflex is not voluntary. It is permissible to put a pill in their hand, which they then take. What if the patient stuck her tongue out and you put a pill on the tongue? Would that be merely physician-assisted suicide or active assistance of suicide? Well, if they can argue about that line in Texas, you can imagine that we'll be arguing about similar lines if it's the physician-assisted suicide versus direct euthanasia that is the line we're continuing to wrestle with in the law. So I don't want to, for a minute, to argue that this decision is unproblematic. It is anything but unproblematic. Sorry, I went 20 minutes instead of 15.
Paul, how does some of the body of law and capital punishment play in this? Because there you have the potential to execute someone who in fact is innocent. Is any of that body of law useful in the overall decision?
I should read the Rothstein decision to see whether it was cited at all. We do accept the risk that a Minnesota person would be killed there. There, however, we have reason to think that the person is not innocent. In the physician-assisted suicide, there's no prima facie evidence of non-innocence to start with. The patient is innocent. They need protecting. We must make sure that this is their will. If there's a significant risk that it's not their will, then maybe we ought to be very cautious and not allow what will often be their will in order to prevent the abuses where it's not their will. I think it's a different background, at least I can see arguments, right? Jim?
Were these patients in the Rothstein decision Washington residents?
Yes, all Washington.
I should know this, but I don't. Is it against the law to commit suicide in Washington?
Washington is a typical state in that the law justifies preventing a person from committing suicide, but if the person attempts suicide, there is no punitive. There's no penalty for it, for humane or practical reasons, perhaps. But so it's illegal, but yet legal. And it is illegal in Washington to assist a suicide, even in the make available sense, not the active assistance sense that's important in the law of Texas.
Or it was illegal until the Rothstein decision.
It was it? Well, in Washington law, it's still it's still illegal, but it's on appeal now. The state attorney general has appealed this.
Everything you've said, I think, presupposes that the person, the subject, the object of the law, has the element of intent.
Yes.
Possesses that and exercises it. And we increasingly have people who are getting into conditions where they do not possess what we can see as intent. So what? So where do we go from here? If this is increasingly, in other words, it is as if carried to the extreme, this point would become moot.
The general line of law in allowing death to come decisions, not any active embracings, but allowing death to come decisions, is that even if a person is no longer competent to make a decision, if they have left clear evidence of what their decision was, or
that's
would be.
The living will thing.
Yeah.
It's the living will, but more than the living will, that a living will has to fit with other sorts of things in there. In testimony about what sort of person they were, what they said, then in a certain order of priority, in Washington state law at least, proxy decision makers, sometimes designated by the patient who's now incompetent, by so-called durable power of attorney for healthcare, sometimes not designated, in which case the state has stipulated a natural order of proxy decision maker, parent first, child second, sibling third. Is that the order? Spouse first, parent second.
I think you should probably have a known and living will, but you should have some kind of your primary physician, whoever you want. And with your family, let that all be known. What you.
Yes. But the key here, all of those elements, and there are a variety of them, communication with the physician, leaving a living will, giving a proxy power by durable power of attorney, all those things speak to a more fundamental standard, which is there clear and convincing evidence that letting death come now, when the patient is incompetent, represents the will of the patient?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, there is a case where that's not really the question. The question is whether or not it represents the best interest of the patient. If there is no will of the patient to interpret, because the patient, for example, never said anything or has been incompetent from birth, then it's the best interest standard that applies. But in these allowing death to come cases, the standard is there evidence that this is the patient's will. And then, even though the patient is currently incompetent, proxy decision makers can act and let death come. The parallel would be where there was equally clear and convincing evidence that the patient would want active assistance, even though they are now incompetent. But it is, I think, more difficult, I suspect more difficult to have that in the case of administration of active lethal agents. Not impossible, but more difficult. For a variety of perceived reasons in our society, namely most people do regard the administration of active lethal agents, self-administered or by others, as an additional step above and beyond just the refusal of life-saving medical treatment, so that most people, unless they've stated very clearly otherwise, need to reach an extra clear point of not just willingness to die, but demand to die, strong embracing of death, before we can say it's their will that active lethal agents be used. And if we don't have them right now to consult, that's going to be a more difficult nest of things to get clear in a particular case. Not impossible, but more difficult. So I don't think it's clear from the Rothstein decision that people have a constitutional right to physician-assisted suicide that we will arrive necessarily at a point where we say people have a right to ensure in advance that active agents will be used later at a certain point. Because the question will always be, at what point? That's not a dilemma in the physician-assisted suicide case where the patient is right there competent to say, at this point.
I think a real tough one that's wound up in this, from practical experience, is taking the individual in a what we generally term as non-compass condition, or have, what do they know? What do they sense? People who can be shown souvenirs of their childhood and identify it, or not. What do they know? What is the amount of life still there that we think of in the conventional sense? Is substantial and therefore should not be tampered with. Can you speak to that?
Well, I'll speak to it by just noting some intercultural comparisons here. Americans often think of the Dutch as the radicals on this question of euthanasia because they practice, now with the consent of their legal system, active euthanasia. The Dutch look at the Americans as the radicals in this business because the Americans have much more fully embraced than the Dutch have letting death come when the patient is incompetent. The Dutch are much more cautious about letting a patient die if the patient is now incompetent. Because they say, how do you know that this is the patient's will? They were a different person before when they're incompetent than they are now. And their state of life now, I mean, well, it's the state of life of the incompetent person they are. And maybe that's valuable to that incompetent person in ways that that person can't express and in ways that the person previously, when competent, would never have dreamt of. And so they tend to be much more conservative on passive euthanasia decisions when the patient is incompetent than the Americans are. On the other hand, they're much more embracing of active euthanasia when the patient is competent. It is very, very much a problem what the will of the patient is when the patient is now incompetent. And I think it's not at all clear that prior advance directives tell us what the will of the patient is. The will of the patient now is, in a sense, a construct anyhow, if the patient is incompetent.
I just want to say I'm on the practical side. I'm a medical oncologist, and I've been practicing medical oncology for about 20 years, and there's so much you to talk about, I don't know where to start. There really is. And I lose about 75, 80 people a year to terminal, you know, to cancer. And you know, first thing I want to say is that I think in those 20 years, despite the fact that probably half of my patients had enough morphine at home to kill themselves whenever they want, I've never had a patient do it. I've had one patient commit suicide in the night. But everybody, and especially in hospice care, we don't count morphine pills. We tell people, we give them guidelines, and they take enough morphine to cover their pain. And they can vary a lot from hour to hour and day to day. But most of them have a week's supply of morphine would be plenty to kill themselves. But nobody does that. But that's one thing. I think in the practical world, the stuff you read in the newspapers, there's thousands of people dying every day of cancer who have the means at home to do it already. The second thing is this business about sticking out your tongue. We have people in our hospice units where we have morphine running IV all the time to cover their pain, where they no longer can swallow pills. And the kind of injections where you actually have that, where there's no doubt that we shorten their lives by covering the pain by running them up.
Can they control the level of morphine directly?
They can certainly tell the nurse turn it up or turn it down. That's standard practice. And the nurse makes a value judgment about some of that all the time. And some of them are unconscious. And they have to go by body posturing and grimacing and things like that. The family has to help us. If the family knows the patient the best, it has to tell us that kind of thing. But and that goes on all the time. The other thing that you touched on is the business about confidence. And the confidence varies all the time. People who are, a lot of our patients have been battling cancer for maybe 4 or 5 years. And are very strong, well together. Most of them have gone through a lot of suffering in order to stay alive for a long time. And the idea of dying can vary a lot. Somebody can have terrible bone pain, maybe a tumor in their bones, can feel like filling out a healthcare declaration, and then get relief of the pain with radiation therapy or surgery, and have it be a different frame of mind the next month. Or they can be on morphine and not be confident, and tell their families they want certain things, or they're not confident, and override what they've already written down. It's tricky.
It's certainly one of the precedents in the culture that influences, that allows a decision like the Rothstein one to come forth from the legal system is the fact that we have actively assisted death. That is, we administer morphine to the levels where it quickens death, not just
you
got to
make
pain.
A choice between quantity and pain. There's no question it goes on all the time.
But the focus of the intention there is to deaden the pain, not
right.
In the typical examples
right.
To
that was a byproduct, for sure.
To create death.
Yeah, right.
But
there are people who are since this has gotten more oppressed, I'm now getting more people who not the patients so much. In my practice, it's more the families, the children coming in from different parts of the country. We don't have much time. A lot of times it's a practical thing where somebody's unconscious in a hospice unit or at home. The family comes in from with them. They've got stuff going on at home. They've got to arrange the funeral. They've got to take care of their legal stuff. They don't have time to wait around 2 weeks for somebody to die who's already unconscious. That's where some of the pressure, from the practical standpoint, that's where some of the pressure comes on us. Our parent can't talk to us anymore anyway. They're unconscious, their pain is relieved. Why do we have to wait another 2 weeks, another week, another day to get this over with?
Well, what if the conversation was held beforehand when the patient was confident about that precise scenario?
They don't talk about that. They don't talk about it. And parents don't talk about that with their kids very much.
But what if a parent insisted on talking about it?
Yeah.
Because the parent who
because you can't ever
knew.
Know until you've been in that situation, you cannot predict that. You just don't know how you would respond.
Yeah.
It would be hard to do it theoretically in advance.
Well, there are some people, at least one of the patients, I've been told, it wasn't described clearly in the Rothstein movie, but one of the patients in that case was a person who was what you might call an aggressive manager of death. And really took charge of the conversational relations on this matter. And I surmise that if that patient were in the situation you describe, while they were still competent, they wouldn't want to miss that last, those last days of competence at all. They would want to make sure that their, what their children's understanding of the situation was, and they might well not want to inconvenience their children, and they might want to, they might say, if I get to a point where I'm not responding, then I want you not to to wait. That's not everybody's choice.
It
will be some individuals.
The other part about this, it gets tricky sometimes, is some people have had maybe a couple of marriages. They've got two batches of kids. There's some money involved here. There's oftentimes at stake. It's very difficult for us on our side to know what's motivating people to want to get this person's life over with.
That's why the Dutch say, why do you so quickly allow these proxy decisions? Maker cases. They're not at all surprised. They're not at all particularly bothered by physician-assisted suicide. They're not even bothered by some cases of directly administered suicide. Directly administered euthanasia, but they voluntary euthanasia. But they are very bothered by the proxy decision maker cases.
I would suspect that the people who would want physician-directed, physician's help in committing suicide might not as much be those dealing with cancer, because they've already committed themselves in many ways to a fight, to fighting this cancer. But to those who are seeing death as a fearful thing to encounter in the future, or that life with a lot of disabilities may be so unpleasant that they would want to get it over with. And I would guess, I kind of got the sense that this was this type of people that Kevorkian was dealing with.
Kevorkian's patients are very different generally than the Rothstein patients. The Kevorkian patients see themselves as entering the stage of incompetence, and they want now to make the decision and do what will prevent them from deteriorating into that state, given their value system about what level of life is, what kind of life is worth living. I don't know, the Rothstein decision doesn't transparently apply to those cases.
Okay, so because that's definitely dealing with more people who are more terminal.
Right.
What does Rothstein, or the Dutch for that matter, say about the nature of the terminal issue that these people must face? I mean, we had some questions over here about whether suicide is illegal or not. It seems to me that you talked about the difference between physician-assisted suicide and physicians actively taking a role. And in the former case, you have the patient resolving the question of coercion and other things. Well, there's a real distinction between letting patients die and letting them take their lives as well. Because in the prior case only, you deal with the definitional problem of are they terminal by whether or not priming them or failing to take a step will give rise to their death. Where in this circumstance, you may not, you may have someone who is not fighting cancer, but somebody who simply doesn't want to continue to live with a disability or with a their perception of the medical situation they face, or maybe even a circumstance in which there will be some dispute about whether they're terminal at all. In that circumstance, does Rothstein say there ought to be some test that says, you know, is this an instance in which you should be, the patient should be allowed to exercise a constitutional right to terminate life? Or is she saying, we all, at all times in our lives, should be free to make that personal decision because it's our life?
She's not saying the latter, that at all times we should be allowed to make that decision. One of the elements that distinguishes suicide in non-terminal illness cases, situations from suicide in terminal illness situations is that there's a stronger argument that the society should state in unequivocal terms to the person who has a lot of life left, though we could argue about what a lot is, to the person who has a lot of life left, the society should in unqualified terms say, we value you, even when you think your life isn't worth living. Because the we value you will help you value your own life. That's one of the very strong arguments for society's ban on suicide. And that argument is missing in the case of terminal illness, well, imminent terminal illness, and demonstrably very difficult to control pain. The Rothstein decision cases were all cases where the patients were in diseases that were typically very pain-laden diseases. And there, when a person has suffered a lot, is the society willing to say, your life is worth valuable beyond, is valuable beyond, way beyond the level of value that you ascribe to it? Or amidst that pain, does society not instead say, gosh, that's an awfully tough decision for us on the outside to understand. Maybe you should. Maybe we can't confidently say that you're embracing death too early. In the typical suicide case, society can and undoubtedly should say, you're embracing death too early. But in these cases, can it say that with any confidence? Rothstein said it can't if the circumstances really are ones that are as difficult and pain-laden as these cases. Now, and that doesn't vary. I don't think she would think with that isn't that observation isn't contradicted by the fact that very few people will finally carry it out if they have the means. It's still the case that it's their decision to make, she would observe. Can society in those cases, she would ask, sustain its judgment that society's observation that life is very much worth living trumps the individual's decision that the life should end? Society has so many reservations about intruding at that point that the cases just are different. But where the line between them? I mean, we could talk till doomsday about where the line is between them, but the law always has those terribly difficult lines.
Not just where the line is, but who decides where the line is. Right. You leave it up to the patient, or the doctor, or the courts, or
something. Rothstein wasn't saying a conservative line shouldn't be drawn there. She's just saying there is a distinction between those two sorts of cases. Jim?
From a legal standpoint, it seems to me this decision is kind of, seems to me, as a lawyer, that it's kind of hard to uphold. The right of privacy that it seems to be based on is nowhere written in the Constitution. As Justice Douglas said, it emanates from the penumbras of the Constitution. And a whole lot of stuff has been based on that. Now, from a moral standpoint, it may be the right decision that the state should not interfere in certain extremist situations where people are on death's door and are competent and are suffering greatly. Perhaps that from a moral standpoint that's the case, but it's awfully hard, I think, to make a distinction. I mean, if you have a privacy right to die when you want to, then you have a privacy right to die when you want to. It shouldn't make any difference if you're an extremist. Shouldn't make any difference if you're in pain. you have a privacy right to die when you want to. And I think that's the difficulty with the right of privacy. It is fuzzy. It just sort of oozes out in all kinds of directions, and there's no bright line distinction that the law can make with much specificity, I think.
I agree that it's fuzzy. I think Rothstein might agree, too, that it was fuzzy. But
that's why it's so useful. I mean, you can come to almost any decision you want to.
That doesn't mean we can't discriminate between cases where the substance of the privacy interest at stake seems more weighty than in other cases. In the case of the person who's not terminally ill at all, again, to get back to that case, should Judge Rothstein say, well, if you really believe, should she simply observe that there's a wide variety of convictions in society about whether it's permissible to embrace death in those non-terminal illness situations. Therefore, it's protected as much under freedom of religion and the penumbra of privacy as it is in the terminal illness cases.
It wouldn't be hard to argue that. I mean, life is terminal.
But all of these rights get merged. One of the things I think that's interesting about the Rothstein decision, and to some extent the Kurzan decision too, is it didn't draw a sharp line between the so-called liberty interest cases and the fundamental right cases. And I wonder whether that, in lawyers' terms, the fundamental right is one where it takes a tremendously weighty argument or consideration in the interest of society to outweigh the individual's autonomy. And the fundamental and the liberty interest is distinct from the fundamental right. The interest only needs to be addressed, and even a rational, not compelling societal interest on the other side is enough to trump it. Do I have that roughly correct?
Yep, Jim? That's right. To put them into one category or another determines the outcome. If
right.
It's a fundamental right, the state can't do anything about it. If it's a liberty interest, the state can do anything it wants to as a practice.
But that line, too, is artificial.
Right.
And what Rothstein and some of these other cases, I think the Kurzan decision are saying is, we can have liberty interests and privacy rights, which can be called by both those labels. It doesn't mean they're merely liberty interests that can be outweighed by any consideration that the state plausibly cites, nor does it, and on the other extreme, doesn't mean that the right is so fundamental that the state would have to cite something incredibly compelling. It will vary by case, and in the case of physician-assisted suicide, it may not be a fundamental right, but it's more than a weak liberty interest, and it requires the state to cite more than merely some factor consideration against it. It requires the state to cite something very sizable, and it hasn't been able to do that in this case. Whereas in the case of the suicide, the non-terminal illness case, it can cite something very, very sizable. The need for society to tell people when society really does have very widely shared reasons for believing this, that your life is valuable even when you don't think it's sufficiently valuable.
What if Judge Rothstein was in Texas, where it's the fundamental public policy of Texas is that people can kill themselves?
But notice Texas. But Texas says it's dangerous for society to reinforce that. That's why Texas too bans physician-assisted suicide, directly physician-assisted suicide. So even Texas has elements in its law that I think allow us to continue to draw the distinction between the terminal illness suicides and the other suicides. Obviously, we should be very worried about where this whole business is taking our society. If we get to a point where, as a society, we don't state in unqualified terms to the person, I mean, take the paradigmatic, and not just paradigmatic, but real paradigmatic teenage suicide case. If we can't state to that person, your life is valuable even when you think it isn't worth living, then we've really become corrupt as a society. We've lost a lot of nurture and all sorts of other things. But But, and some people will charge that failing to state in unqualified terms your life is valuable even when you think things are so tough that it's now time to end it. Some people will think that society could continue to say that even in the most extreme terminal illness cases. But let's be honest with ourselves. We have many more doubts about the security of that statement by society to the terminal, the ill, pain-fraught patient than we do about the statement of, that statement of society to the 17-year-old. People, somebody who hasn't yet. Let's see, Ruth, I do. I can't remember.
Actually, it's sort of that idea of whether society does really have a concern for the life of the patient. Because I suspect that our that particular concern is eroding as our population increases. And our money situation increases, and the health bill problem increases. There is more of a concern to say, now how can we eliminate some of the people that are costing us a lot of money? How can we comfortably find a way, justifiably, to let death happen to these people that up till now we have ostensibly been saying, oh, they shouldn't die, yet before the law really started to define it, there was a lot of allowing death, helping suicide, helping people to die.
But now it's much more dangerous to
now
do even that.
Now it's much more dangerous, yeah.
Yeah, but that's why the Dutch are so astonished that we've embraced the allowing to die so completely, even in the proxy decision-maker cases.
But I think this is going to continue to go, first of all, perhaps narrow further, defining more, and then I think our society is going to say, somewhere along the line, we are going to allow a lot more deaths than we have been allowing. Or encouraging, or permitting, or enabling a lot more deaths than society has been saying they've been permitting. And I think there is not the concern for the value of individual life to bring us to. Though there is talk about it. But I think you find in societies like, you know, the white society is still saying, well, what happens to the Spanish, what happens to the black is not as important. And there are some real different values.
It is not just individuals and families and churches and all the other private institutions of society should be very, very alert to these problems. But it is not just individuals, it is also the legal system and the government that should be alert to these abuses. But the government has to, in our system, be very careful about where it draws the line. And a line must be drawn because some patient rights must be protected. Do we want to go back to a day and age when at death's doorstep, you couldn't say no to extra heroic surgery? No, we don't want to go back to that, even though that case of letting you decide to embrace death is fraught with potential abuse too, because you might have been talked into it or be told unwittingly by, wittingly or unwittingly by society, subtly by society. Well, if you get to that point, your life's not worth living. And that's why you believe your life isn't worth living, not because you really autonomously yourself think that. Sure, there are tremendous social pressures that we have to deal with, but and society has, the legal system should give very careful consideration to where that balance of considerations falls, and it seems to me that it is not at all clear that Rothstein herself would extend this decision to any non-competent patient cases of using active lethal agents. She may not at all, for precisely your reasons, and she may even want to retrench somewhat on some of the permissibility of proxy decision makers in the passive. We are at an hour. I think we should break. We must break. We must break it now.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you for coming.